Hulk Hogan is Santa with an attitude.
Keep the milk and cookies warm.
Santa with some friends. And most of all,
they can't start Christmas without me, can they?
He's Santa with muscles.
Welcome to the SantaCast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Folks, you have tuned in for a very special episode today. It is very special for a couple of reasons. I'll get to that in just a moment. But if you've been following this show for the last month or so, then you know that our previous episode, our holiday music episode, was also a very special one for a different reason. We spent some time talking about New Year's music on that episode and talking about the year 2016. As many people will tell you, it was an interesting year overall, and interesting for many reasons and many people, including one Terry Hulk Hogan Boella. Although he wasn't in the ring like any wrestler, he had some wins and losses in 2016. He won a court case against Gawker Media, which effectively bankrupted the company, but he was also outed for having made racial slurs on tape, which led to him quickly being scrubbed from the website of the house that Hulk built, the WWE. I don't want to linger on either of those things right now, though. You want info? It's out there. You can go look it up. But I do want to focus my attention on Hulk Hogan, specifically Old Hogan. Let's wind the clock back here for a moment to 20 years ago, 1996. Back then, Hogan was well past his wrestling zenith. Gone were the 1980s when he was the invincible, unstoppable, money-printing, money-making machine for the WWE, but he was still wrestling in the 90s, and he was a headliner for the WWE's biggest competitor, the WCW. And he was continuing to make movies, and that is where we're going to be today. Let me stop beating around the peppermint bark and get right to it. This is a very special SaftaCast for two reasons. One, we don't just have one guest. We have two. Letitia Trent, poet and bad movie aficionado, and Todd Canego, poet and pro wrestling scholar. And the second reason is we are totally off script today from talking about writing, editing, publishing, and some of our personal passions and learning about our guests. Today, we have only one mission on the program: to watch, discuss, and try to figure out one of the worst films, according to the users at the International Movie Database, Santa with Muscles. Now, maybe you've never seen this film, and that's probably for the best for you and your sanity, but if you would like to experience the movie alongside with us, I will tell you this only, that it is a not hard movie to find. You just do a quick internet search for it, and no doubt you'll find it out there somewhere. On the other hand, if you want to spare your mind and body and soul from pain, here's a quick synopsis for you of the film. Hulk Hogan stars as Blake Thorne, a rich jerk from California who gets hit on the head and thinks that he's really Santa Claus. And then, so because of that, he tries to save an orphanage from St. Elsewhere and Hollywood Square star Ed Begley Jr. because there's, like, crystals underneath the orphanage that's also a church and only has, like, I don't know. It's a little bit confusing. Thankfully, we've got two guests on the program today to help us figure it out and how we feel about it, and I'll tell you right now, it's a fun one, folks. So, if you are setting up your final preparations at home for the holidays, maybe to receive some guests and everything, we're glad you're tuning us in while you work on them, and if you're traveling, we are glad we are along for the ride, and you're along for the ride with us as we sit down now for a special roundtable discussion of the movie Santa with Muscles. Enjoy. holidays, guys.
Back at you, both.
Yeah.
Thank you both for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know December is hellish. But thank you both for coming on and agreeing to do this episode as a roundtable.
I'm totally happy to be here to talk about Santa with Muscles.
Yeah, I'm very excited to really, like, figure out this film with you guys.
Well, I couldn't have asked for two better people to talk about this with. Letitia, let's start with you. What's your overall thoughts on this film?
You know, I watched this movie with my eyes, like, really big. I was just like, what is happening? And I kind of love that feeling. That's why I like B-movies, because it can just... Things can just happen and you don't know why or what's going on, really. And I find that kind of exciting. So I enjoyed the experience of watching this. Yeah, and Hulk Hogan, he's something else. That's all I can say right now, yeah.
Todd, do you share that or what's your thought on this?
I do share it. You know, I have a fondness for B-movies as well and a severe love for professional wrestling. So in a lot of ways, this movie should have been like everything I could have ever wanted. But, you know, I feel like I left the movie a little, like, really confused about what I was supposed to be feeling about what was about Christmas, and about Santa, and about hucksters who try to steal credit cards, and scientists. It left me very confused, really confused. Like, you told us, like, hey, you should watch this movie and take some notes. And I was having trouble trying to figure out what kind of notes I should be taking.
I ended up having 5.5 pages of notes on this film.
Oh, my. Wow. Wow. That is some dedication.
I can't help it when I analyze a film. I just have to get in deep. Letitia, were you confused by this film as well by the end?
I was deeply confused by this film. But, you know, my background's poetry, and I feel like I'm just always confused by any text put before me, and I'm okay with confusion. I don't know. I was just kind of enjoying the fact that I did not know. Yeah, but what the idea of, like, what are we supposed to feel about Santa? What's Christmas? Like, what's going on? The lesson you're supposed to learn? I don't know. I don't know what my lesson is. And usually Christmas movies, there's a pretty hard-hitting lesson. Like, obviously, you know.
This movie has everything I should have loved, right? It's got pro wrestlers in it. It's got Santa who sometimes has superpowers. It has evil scientists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I feel like it's a genius movie that goes, like, full speed at everything, but in a totally half-assed way, right? It's like... It's a cartoon, kind of, but it's afraid to really be a cartoon. It's got fighting scenes, right? But it's got these really lazy fighting scenes that are like, if you took Mr. T out of the A-Team and put him into this movie, Mr. T would be like, you know, I can fight these guys a lot better. Maybe we can just have, you know, a black Santa with muscles. So I felt really, you know, and also it's Hulk Hogan, but it's not really Hulk Hogan, half-assed.
That's true. Totally. I did miss, like, Hulk Hogan like that. Yeah. He was trying to act in some weird way. And I didn't want that. Like, that, he was trying to be an actor, you know, instead of being Hulk Hogan, which would have been way more fun, in my opinion.
Well, like, Hogan is Hogan, like, in every other avenue of his life, right? He's, you know, he does that reality show, he's Hogan. He does an interview. He goes and eats in a restaurant. He's Hogan. And in this movie, and I think most of his movies, suddenly he's not Hogan. And I just wanted to be like, what you going to do, brother, when Christmas goes wild on you, you know, and flex the pythons. But this is at a weird time, I think, you know, in his career, and a weird time for Christmas.
This film comes out in 96, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Todd. This is right when he's starting to become a major player of WCW and the NWO.
Yeah. So, like, he turns heel in July, right? July of 96, he turns heel. He drops a leg drop on Randy Savage and tells the fans to go stick it, right?
Mm.
It's the hugest heel turn to that point in pro wrestling. You had Hulk Hogan, the perennial good guy. Suddenly, he's a bad guy, right? So... 5 months later, in November, this movie comes out, and he's Blake, and he's Santa. And so I left, you know, just – I was kind of looking at it in this really weird historical context where you have the biggest heel in wrestling being the good guy in this movie. I feel really confused as to sort of how am I supposed to take Hogan in this, you know? How am I supposed to understand both his character in this movie and then – his character as a pro wrestler, as, you know, as a guy you're supposed to hate. And who's going to go see a movie with, you know, this guy who's just told you to go stick it? So
so if it had, like, been made in 1986, this perfect movie would have made more sense.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Might have. I wasn't watching wrestling at the time.
No, I wasn't either.
But I did see this. I did see this film in like 97 or 98 on VHS.
Oh, wow.
Wow. I'm a teenager. I'm about 18 at the time, so I could handle crap much better than I could now.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to revisit this film 20 years later and go, wow, I know so much more about actors and filmmaking. This is interesting. So let's just dive right into this film and try to make some sense of it here. My first note that I had was this film opens like a horror film.
Yes! Oh my gosh! That was exactly what my thought was. I was like, it seems like a horror movie. And that's mostly what I watched. So I was kind of like, oh, where's this going? Yeah, I think that might have been an accident. I don't know if there was a lot of intentional anything in this movie. But it was a strange feeling.
And it's called Cabin Fever Entertainment. I was like, oh, boy.
It kind of starts with all that chaos, right? She's writing the letter. The little girl's writing the letter. And there's all that chaos outside. And I was like, oh, someone's getting murdered out there.
Yes!
It was crazy. And I'm not used to sort of B movies being not scary or not dark or not, you know, I'm not used to sort of a B movie being this sort of lighthearted. Was this a theatrical release or was this on TV?
Mm.
It did get a theatrical release. It lasted 2 weeks and only made $200,000.
Well, that's great. Aww. So it's a theatrical movie. So it's a real B movie and not like a TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that confuses me even more.
This movie bombed terribly. So we open with this creepy shot of a mansion with activity. And then the girl, Elizabeth, this little girl who seems to just know everything about the story. She's the expository voice here.
Oh, that's a good point.
She's a never good sign when the movie 1 minute in has told you the entire setup.
But I still had no idea what was happening for a long time. Even though we got the setup, I was like, wait, who? The doctor? Anyway, I shouldn't get in the way here. You're going through the beginning.
So after we get that, she gives a whole expository info and everything. We get a shot of the orphanage and our first, like, action of anything. What the hell's going on? Are these guys repoing the tree? Like a truck is dragging the
I think they're terrorizing their landscape, right? They're just going to like tie their truck to stuff and drive away with it?
I don't know about you guys. I felt like I was in for a ride because the first actor we see on screen is Garrett Morris running after a truck going, "That's our tree!" Oh boy. Then we get to see our first appearance of Blake Thorne, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, I told you, never stop to smell the roses. And that was his first line. And then I knew, oh no, here we go. Right? That's a line that even I don't think Arnold would utter even. You know?
Oh, the lines here are great. There's so many ones that I loved. But yeah, my favorite comes later and we'll talk about that.
I have a note on that. Never stop to smell the roses. James Bond quip level, this ain't.
Yeah. And then that fight scene really confused. They're making all those weird sounds. It's like they were going to holler and make some monkey sounds so that Blake knows they're coming, right? I was confused with this fight scene up until I saw the weed whacker. And once I saw the weed whacker, I was in. I was like, okay, sweet. This is a real fight.
And what happens is that basically Blake is this rich guy who's trained his staff to randomly attack him to keep his combat skills up.
But super loudly, so like, doesn't that sort of defeat the purpose? they're always screaming and shouting
I mean, there's Inspector Clouseau did the same thing, right? He had that house servant who would attack him. Right? But even he would like. There was some sneaking around in that one, you know.
Yeah, Blake gets to hide in the woods in the weeds, and his opponents have to scream at him. One of them does come at him with a weed whacker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was serious.
That's serious right there versus a silver omelet tray as his defense.
Have you ever been hit by a silver omelet tray?
No, I have not.
Me either. I don't want to be. So I'm not going to knock the silver omelet tray as a weapon.
No, it could be effective.
The tiny tire iron, I feel like he could have gotten a big one, you know?
The Weed Whacker makes two appearances. Like, he tries it first, he's deflected by the plate, but then he comes at Blake again with it. And I found it interesting, like, on the second or third viewing. Dear God, I can't believe I said that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He has, if you look closely, he puts the Weed Whacker right up against Hogan's neck and revs it.
And that was scary, wasn't it?
Knowing that he's the star of the picture, I'm like, that is obviously not a working Weed Whacker. A question for you both on this one, because it's shortly after this we get to see Hogan a little clearer and not in movement. Did he look off to you physically?
Like Botox, do you mean? Or like in the facial area?
Well, I'm thinking, I grew up watching Hogan as this giant of a man in the ring.
Mm.
But he looks really thin and gaunt here.
He looks small.
This is the period of time, like, the WWF got hit with the steroid scandal, right? And so he's off the juice right here. He is much slimmer and much less muscular because he's not taking the juice. He's cleaned up because he has to. And if you watch him sort of like, if you watch him in that sort of the beginning of that the WCW run, when he joins the NWO, he's much, much slimmer. He doesn't have that same musculature that he did back, you know, in 1987.
Yeah, you notice it in this film, I think, when he has the dinner scene later, and they get a shot of, like, you can see, like, his neck is, like, you can see the cords in his neck now. And it's like, well, then.
I noticed that while he was driving. When he's driving, you can see his neck, and he's got a normal human neck, as opposed to, like, that thick, you know, Hulk neck that he had back in, you know, the 80s, so...
So was this title then a misnomer for the film?
I did have that thought. Like, he just doesn't look physically imposing. I mean, not physically imposing.
So I mean, he's still a huge guy, right?
Right.
I mean, he's still taller than anybody else in the movie, isn't he? Definitely.
The way they film it looks like that. I feel like sometimes he's filmed in a way to look bigger.
The Rock could pull it off. I think if Dwayne Johnson did this movie now, he could pull off Santa with muscles. But...
Mm-hmm.
Hogan, I'm questioning here. So, okay, yeah, speaking of him driving, that's what happens next, basically, is Chaz lays out Blake's rules, 300 rules, like the Ferengi rules of acquisition here.
Yeah.
Rules for living, you know.
I wanted those rules to be so much better, didn't you?
Well, they were just like bad guy rules, rich guy, like Ayn Rand with muscles rules, like, you know, make a lot of money. What was the one? There was one I remember. Oh, I thought I remembered it. Never lend a hand, you might need it later.
Yeah.
That was one of them.
You know, you think about it, when you stop to think about it, it's like, okay, he's rich, he's cocky, he's combat trained. He's like Batman without any appeal.
Yeah, you know, later on in the movie, I find myself wishing that he was like an ex-con or something. Because I wish he was an ex-con who like learned to be a good guy, or I wanted him to be like, you know, something like that. Because really, he's just kind of a dick. It was not nearly as compelling a turn, right? Where he discovers, oh, I can do this good thing. But he's not a guy running around doing bad things. He's just a guy who's running around doing things.
Right. He's just doing like stupid things that don't make sense.
This movie is full of stupidity.
But I think this could be a good thing. I mean, I think there's been some really great movies that have been full of stupidity.
Right. Sometimes movies need more stupidity, really. But yeah, not this one.
Actually, I think the movie could have used a lot more stupidity.
Oh, okay.
I mean, those scientists are stupid.
Right.
But they could have been so much more stupid. You know, the farting one. I mean, there's a 40 scientist. Great. I just kind of wanted to be better. But he was just stinky, you know.
This is infuriating stupidity here.
It's the wrong kind of stupid. That's what it is. The wrong kind.
So speaking of stupid, Todd, you mentioned the paintball scene.
Yeah, it was stupid. But it could have been so much better. I mean, it's sort of like one of those things where you're going to have a paintball fight, but then you don't really have a paintball fight. We just have paintball guns, you know? And sure, there's dramatic device. You need to get some red paint on him so that Lenny thinks it's blood later. Sorry, spoiler. But then, like, man, there could have been a paintball shootout, a paintball duel. Yeah, so much more to be done with the paintball guns.
all it is I think the gun is shot like three times. And I guess it's like motorized paintball. They're supposed to chase each other in vehicles and tag each other.
I totally want to watch that.
And there's been good paintball scenes before. Like Friday the 13th Part 6 has a great paintball scene.
My friends have had great paintball scenes that are better than the paintball scene in this movie. You know, I just feel like, yeah, here's another, it's just an example of where the movie, it just kind of half-asses the paintball, you know, it never really gives us as much the paintball the way it could.
But it does give us one good moment. It gives us our introduction to the discount Wallace Shawn, Clint Howard.
Ron Howard's ugly little brother?
Mm-hmm. Then we get Blake now assaults the police officer and leads him on a high-speed chase.
Yeah, because that's one of Blake's rules, right? Never give up?
Never surrender,
oh,
yeah.
Never surrender. Oh, man.
Which is better in Galaxy Quest.
Well, they think he's a terrorist. That was the weirdest thing. He's a terrorist? I don't know. It just everything was strange, but that part was strange. That they assumed he was a terrorist, and that's why they had to chase him. Uh-huh. I don't know.
And don't you call in the feds at that point?
I know, like, yeah, I'll go get that terrorist. I'm just a local police officer.
Yeah, and he's wearing Gulf War era fatigues too. So I don't know if that's really helping. But
this is the part that really bugged me about the movie. I forget where it is in the movie, but at some point he's driving, he's chasing him in his car, Clint Howard, and he says something about like, "I'm a Gulf War vet. I can
right.
do this."
Yes.
But such a putz in the movie. And I felt like I didn't understand what happened there. They're making fun of vets right there, I thought. And
yeah, I didn't know what it was. I was like, is that making fun of him, or is that not true?
And I know the line you're talking about, because I have it noted here. Is like, "I was in Desert Storm. I'm a heartbreaker. I'm a troublemaker."
Oh my God.
I like those other two lines. I might start saying those.
They just don't make sense with the one before it. Or
yeah. Is he quoting Pat Benatar? Is he quoting Zeppelin there?
That's exactly. It's not Benatar, right?
It makes no sense. Like, the line makes no sense. I'm going to start saying that. Yeah, I think you're right. I'm going to start saying that if I'm in trouble. I'm like, "Don't mess with me, man. I'm a heartbreaker. I'm a troublemaker.
I'm a troublemaker. Don't mess around with me." Yeah.
Okay. Well, Blake runs, takes this chase into his old hometown, which, side note, when you see the movie, how does Blake not remember his childhood if he remembers the town he's from?
I was so confused about that. Like, does he not remember? He doesn't want to admit it? Why would he not remember his childhood? That's before he had amnesia, right? Oh, I'm giving away some things, but
yeah, this is no. He says something like, "Oh, Lakeville. I know a lot of places there to hide. I grew up there."
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, but then, as we'll learn later on, he apparently doesn't remember anything about his childhood. But
yeah.
Oh. Time for more confusion. Blake runs into a shopping mall. I don't have kids. I know both of you do. And have mm-hmm. you ever been to a mall where kids are cheering for Santa to come out?
I want to go to a mall where kids are cheering for Santa to come out. I think that would be awesome.
Right.
But no, I've never seen that.
No, that's like a movie thing. I don't think that happens in real life, just in movies.
Oh, man.
I've never seen people chant for Mall Santa.
Or get mad when he doesn't show up. I don't know. I don't think that happens.
I mean, I was at the mall like a couple days ago and saw the kid sitting on Santa's lap crying, like just full on ugly face crying. And they have like little puppets in front of them trying to make them smile. And those kids, it makes the kids cry harder. So I've seen that. That's what, you know, maybe was missing a little bit.
That's the whole point of having your kid on the lap, really.
I'm going to remember that. We're going tomorrow.
So we get that brief setup, but then we finally get to meet our villains.
Yeah.
We get to finally meet our villains, and we know that Ebner Frost is got to be evil because he's talking to people through a television set like Jigsaw.
Yeah. I want to do that. God.
I don't know. How familiar are you guys with Ed Begley Jr.?
I think he's like a really environment. He's like in environmentalism. That's how I know him. But he just wasn't really doing much here. I think of him. Yeah, he just was sort of showed up and was not at all menacing or particularly scary and had no clear motivations until the end when it still didn't make sense. And
I feel like scientists are not scary, right? And so here's all your villains, and there's a bunch of scientists who are kicked out of their universities, right?
That's pretty scary. I mean, come on.
So, I mean, yeah, why not have, like, henchmen or monsters? Or if you're a scientist, why don't you make some monsters to fight Santa, you know? Because the scientists.
What kind of scientist is he even? What is he doing? Why does he want to? I have a lot of questions. I still don't.
Well, that one guy's a geologist, right?
That's true. That's and one lady has electricity, but I didn't understand why.
Yeah. So we get our three henchmen here. We've got like the geologist guy,
Mr. Flint.
Yeah, Mr. Flint, who apparently Frost is like trying to get some shoe salesman to sell his business. So
right.
The geologist, quote unquote, tortures the guy by brushing his face and saying, "You're going to make a beautiful fossil."
Well, that's kind of an awful threat. I mean, you're making a beautiful fossil.
Especially if you're a geologist making that. I mean, maybe that's why he got kicked out of his university. He conflated paleontology with geology.
He was just really bad at it. He just failed, really, is the problem. Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's our first one. Then we've got Dr. Vile, the stinky guy.
The methane guy.
Yeah, methane guy. Then we get Mrs. Watt with the electric glove. Letitia, you mentioned that, like, she's very confusing.
Yeah, I just didn't understand, like, what? Why are they there? Why are they doing all this? I don't know. It's not that every movie has to explain everything, but I just would like a hint of a sense of why she has an electric glove, for example.
I want internal logic because she uses that glove to explode a flower.
That's one badass glove. Explodes flowers. I can't make electricity explode flowers. Can you?
No.
No. So look how horrible she is. Oh, no. She's an enemy of nature, that one.
Ooh, that's true.
Maybe that's why she got kicked out. A fun casting note. Miss Vile really has... One of the few. She was one of the bitches in RoboCop, the original RoboCop, where Clarence comes in and goes, "Bitches leave. You gonna call me Bobby?" She's one of them. This is her role 10 years later.
You know, I was actually just watching. I was hoping that this movie would, you know, follow the Bechdel rule, right? I was hoping that she would like have a conversation with the orphanage owner about something other than a man.
So now we get Santa in the mall. We finally get to see Hogan dons the Santa outfit when he's running from the cops. And just as a fun note, he meets his first kid. We get like the bad Santa moment. And the kid's like, "Hey, Santa, here's my list," and rolls it. If you freeze frame it, the fourth thing on his list is a Hulk Hogan doll.
Is it really?
That's
fantastic. For me, this creates so many questions about the film universe.
Right.
Like, is Hogan real or her?
I mean, shouldn't have someone, like, mistaken him for Hulk Hogan, right? At the mall. "You're not Santa. You're Hulk Hogan." It's like, "Shut up, kid. Stick it."
It'd be like an airplane with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. "You are Kareem."
Yeah, exactly. You're not Santa. You're better. You're Hulk Hogan. No, I'm not. I'm an actor.
No, I'm not. Yay, you try slamming Andre the Giant.
What was that kid doing back in that area anyways?
What was that area? It was terrifying.
Well, that's what I used to work at a mall, like in high school. I worked in a bookstore in a mall, and behind every store has like a back door, which leads to sort of these catacombs behind where like you put your trash or your recycling and sort of like there's these, you know, these behind areas where custodial people, you know, do their work. But I didn't know why the kid was there. I mean, why do you have your kid in the back of the mall?
And it looks like unpainted drywall, like it's under construction.
Yeah, that's what was strange to me. But why is there a big gaping garbage chute? Is that a thing that malls have? Because I was wondering about that. Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. Sorry.
But how far does that go up? Because how far does that chute go up? How many
I don't know. I mean, does that exist? I don't know. Oh, but my favorite thing is that he tells the kid to fax him the list. Which was a great choice not to date the movie by having him fax the list.
Oh, the purest 90s moment in this is toward the end of the film when the kid says, "See ya, don't want to be ya." I'm like, that's it. That's the most 90s moment of the film for me.
Oh, he should have been like, "I'm Audi 5000. That would have also been good.
But you're right, though. So Santa, to hide, he gets into a garbage chute that's like four stories up in the building.
And it's just open and flapping in the wind. I don't understand. This is just a big, like, risk if there's going to be children back there. There really shouldn't be a gaping open.
I hadn't thought of it. If you're bringing the kids back there, there's a freaking garbage chute there that could kill them.
But the kids should have, all the other kids are like out waiting for Santa, cheering, right? So what's that one kid doing there in the back? I don't know. I feel like, is dad just taking him behind the scenes? Well, Santa's not here. Let's go hunt him down.
Well, he's taking things into his own hands, right?
Yes. Well, he found him, I guess.
That's good parenting, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure how Hogan holds on with those gloves, right? He's got those gloves. How good of a grip can he get with those gloves? Does he have the Santa grip gloves?
I don't know.
On the reindeer? I don't know.
Oh, but he doesn't hold on for very long, and he falls down and gets hit on the head by a plastic Santa.
Irony. Or something. Foreshadowing?
Yeah.
That makes him go amnesia, kind of, sort of.
Well, he also hits his head on the way down, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because he hit the bottom, and he hits his head again.
Yeah. So he does go amnesia, though, and then we get Lenny. I just, within 2 minutes, I wanted to punch him.
Yes.
Lenny, just as a side, Lenny tries to move Blake with his legs, you know, drag him, and says, "Oh, you're too heavy." 30 seconds later, he fireman carries Hogan out of the room.
Totally. I saw that. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Of all the things in this movie, that was the one that was the most enraging.
Immersion ruined here.
Can't take this movie seriously after that moment.
Why isn't McMahon recruiting him for the WWE at that time? So he does come out, though, and he does now think he's Santa Claus next to Lenny. And I'm going to be honest, this has one of my first real only laugh in this film. Is where Hogan is talking to the kids, and the one kid can't describe what she wants. And I'm guessing Hogan had to improv, and his suggestion, what do you want? You know, one of the golf ball, pocket knife, electric razor. I genuinely laughed at that one.
I did too. That was charming.
And then we get the old school ATM as Lenny steals the wallet, Blake's wallet.
But with like crazy good like security, right? Did the 90s have fingerprint security?
Yeah, I know. What kind of
thumbprint
thing in 1996 that can read a backwards print on glass and turn it around so he knows that, oh, that's not just your print on glass. That's actually your print, right? It can read that way.
And it has a voice ID. I mean...
Right, it was a real chatty ATM. Just had a lot to say. It was too much.
Then we get our first fight scene as Santa. We finally get to see Santa with muscles as he beats up two obviously bad teenagers because they're wearing a Dare shirt and a shirt that says Anarchy.
Yeah, all they needed was a vest and a mohawk, and they're like right out of the perfect bad guys for the 90s.
And, oh, one has a nose ring, too. That means they're definitely bad facial piercing.
I think in the credits, the guy's just called Nose Ring.
Yeah, he's just called Nose Ring, I think. And the other, I think, is just called Baldy, or somebody's called Baldy, but in any case. There's something I noticed in the fight scene that I don't know what the deal is here. We do get one of the best lines in the fight scene, though. We get somebody in the background is very softly yelling out, "Watch out, he's got a candy cane."
What if they just double-sped all the fight scenes in this movie? It would have been so much better, don't you think? Everything is just like... twice as fast and throw some like vaudeville music over it.
Oh, that would be so beautiful.
But the fight scenes, you know, hey, Hogan's a pro wrestler. I was expecting, you know, he's not a great pro wrestler, but I was expecting better fight scenes than I got. You know, I'm expecting maybe drop the leg on someone, you know, elbow drop, bear hug. better fight scenes.
I'm going to chalk it up to bad stunt fight coordinators on this film. We cut back to Ebner, and apparently the villains, their whole method to take down this guy is by pink belly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, and for some reason, Blake suddenly feels the need to go to this orphanage. And so we're just going to jump right to that orphanage. What are your questions about this orphanage? Because I got a bunch.
Oh my God, why are there only like four kids in this enormous orphanage, A?
Well, they explain that because the rest of them got picked up and these are the ones that didn't get picked up, right?
I know, but is that how orphanages work? I mean, they explained it, right? But it still doesn't make sense. I mean, they said that, but it still doesn't make sense.
No, right.
I don't understand why kids are playing in catacombs. Why are there catacombs? I mean, I have a lot of questions about the catacombs and the crystals and that piece, but yeah, maybe we'll save that for later. I don't know. There's many questions.
There apparently it's a church, but there's no denomination for the, there's no symbology anywhere, no iconography.
What a great spread they get for dinner. I mean, I was kind of expecting just a, you know, a couple card tables and some frozen meat pies or something, but they get a big spread.
We do have a very young first film role here. Mila Kunis is in this as the eldest of the three, and apparently is a master tailor as she fixes Santa's suit.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I like how, like, she has this big belt buckle with S for Sarah, and she has this giant belt buckle, and she just gives it to Santa because Santa starts with S, too.
She's like 10 years old.
And she learned to do that. She learned it from the comic book, right? To do the tailoring.
She learned maybe the design, but not the skill.
Yeah, I didn't understand how you learn tailoring from a comic book.
The comic book's not a seamstress, right? So I'm kidding.
Okay.
I don't know that. I just know that. So here's the thing. So here we got Santa, right? He stops the ice cream truck by grabbing onto that cord, that rope, right? And he just stops it. Saves Garrett Morris, right? So does Santa have that kind of power? Is he that strong all the way through? Because I don't think he is.
Is that like a moment of super, like weird, almost supernatural Santa power? Like,
yeah.
Go ahead.
We also learned that Garrett Morris has superpowers because he teleports, right? Like he's running in front of the truck and then the truck stop, you know, is heading towards him and then suddenly he's like 50 feet away, right? Waving his arms. So there's a lot of superpowers happening in this one scene.
I hadn't noticed that, but I think you're right. It's like he's almost like Nightcrawler in that regard.
Yeah, brimstone.
So the next morning, the reporter Helen Chu has arrived to interview the Santa with Muscles who saved this man's life and all this other stuff. And I wanted Hogan here because when she asked him, Santa, what's your secret? I really wanted him to be like, say your prayers, eat your vitamins.
Yeah, totally. So hey, Blake has amnesia, right? He's not stupid. So, like, how'd you get here, Rooster?
Slay? Reindeer. It's like select amnesia here.
Well, right, but also, does he really think he's Santa? Like, is he have so much amnesia that he's forgotten Santa's not real and thinks he might be him?
Yeah.
I know you have to sort of go with the premise, but yeah.
Agreed. It's something going on here. So then we get probably the creepiest scene. I've seen online reviews of this film, and they point right to this scene, and that is the angel baby scene.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Where Hulk Hogan sings a made-up song called Angel Baby with a child actor. This child really confuses me. One, she has a promise ring on her right hand, and she's like 8.
Ooh.
And two, she is like the impossible, like if you distilled the essence of Cindy Brady and Buffy from A Family Affair into one sweet little girl, that's her.
One sweet little girl who cannot sing.
But apparently the church is filled with fairies in her eyes.
Oh, what a weird scene. Yes, and then the window lights up.
They're on acid. They're acid.
And suddenly, yeah, it feels like, oh my, what is that? It was a different movie for about 2 minutes. And then no one ever comments on the fairies and the windows or anything that happened there.
Oh, I wanted to mention something at the breakfast scene right before that.
Are you talking about the milk? Slow motion where he's watching him drink milk?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, that. Yeah, it suddenly became so strange. As suddenly, you know.
As sensuous.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Like sensual.
That's the sexiest glob of milk I've seen in a while.
Yeah. Because I didn't understand why that was happening. I saw it. I noticed it was fixating on the milk. I think I watched this a little less carefully than you guys because I missed a lot. And I was really confused about why suddenly there was like this sort of sensual attention to him drinking the milk. And then I realized, okay, he's trying to get his fingerprint. But
it took me like halfway through a second viewing to realize that Lenny is in debt to Frost, to Ed Begley Jr. Like, he's in money debt. I never realized that. It's terribly unclear.
He's like half mad scientist, half loan shark.
Side projects, you know. But yeah, along those lines at the breakfast scene, Lenny tries to hide the box of cereal with Blake's face on it.
Mm.
Yet they've all seen now Santa come out without his beard on, so he looks like the guy in the cereal box. They've no doubt seen this box before this morning. And we know from the film he has his face on like 10 different products. How do they not put it together?
What's an orphanage?
That's really all you need to say.
Yeah, an orphanage.
Well, Garrett's character, Clayton, does figure it out because he has that scene right after after the interview where he says something like, you did something with your life. I'm proud of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, there we go. You gave away the plot there, Clayton. All right. So that night, then we get a couple great lines, too, when Santa fights the criminals again outside. I think there's two okay lines here, serviceable ones. There's a new Santa in town. And keep the milk and cookies warm.
Oh, yeah. I like the second one. That's a good one.
I could be okay with it. This begins the third act setup now. The stupidity, real quick. Taylor sees the bad guys get beaten and then says, I'm going to go off and attack Frost's compound alone.
With my slingshot.
He's gone for 3 seconds and they start going, where'd Taylor go? And Hogan goes, I think I know. It's been 3 seconds. Taylor has not gotten across town in 3 seconds.
Well, he has his bike. Kidding. Kidding.
No, that's what they seem to make it seem to be, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, how does Blake know where the compound is? How does the kid know where the compound is? Do we all know where the compound is? And if we all know where the compound is it really a compound or just a house where bad guys live?
Just a really big house.
Yeah. With weird explosions.
We do get to see a little more of Ed's house, Ebner Frost's house, and he has these gas jets all over them. What is going on here?
Well, that might be the thing. Yeah, oh, if we knew what kind of scientist he was, maybe this would help. I don't know. I wish there were a town where there was like a really like evil scientist with a compound. Like, wouldn't you want to live in that town? That'd be so fun.
But we cut back now. Okay, so Ebner's trying to get the orphanage as like the last key to his plan because there's something in the orphanage he wants, and now we find out what that is. Let's talk about these catacombs for a moment.
I mean, are the crystals? So the crystals. So okay, there's a catacomb. They go down. They open it. With the combination, which made no sense to me that they'd only figured out three of the numbers when it makes a huge clicking sound.
Yes!
When you get the right number. Like, and Hulk Hogan knew the right number. He knew it. But there's no questioning of why he knew it. And that's where you see the BL or whatever his name is, Blake something.
Yeah, BT.
BT, that's right. I don't know. I just want these people to ask more questions about what's going on. It would have been nice.
These catacombs are expertly carved, have installed lighting and plumbing, and there's dead corpses down there.
But it's where the kids play. It's their clubhouse.
Yeah, I felt like suddenly I was in the Goonies, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly, you know, there's treasure down there, there's the dead pirate skeletons, and suddenly we're in a different movie, you know?
Yeah, the kids call it their clubhouse. The adults are like, well, we never go down there. We don't know what's down there.
We don't go to the catacombs. This
we just send the kids down there to play. Go down to the dark, kids.
The kids installed the lighting system.
So I think that like the window is made out of these crystals, right?
Oh, no, that makes sense.
That one does? Because the window glows and makes purple lights, and the crystals make crystal lights. Is that what happens? Is that what we're supposed to say?
I was going to say that would explain it, because I did not understand that at all. But aren't the crystals, like, flammable? Don't they explode?
Yeah. The Mila Kunis somehow knows, like, advanced geology, because she says something like, these crystals are sonic quartz. Yeah. If they vibrate enough, they generate electricity. The kid, Taylor, drops one on the ground and it explodes. Yet, spoiler, later on, Blake and Ebner are fighting with them as lightsabers and they don't explode.
This movie is so weird. Once they got to crystal catacombs and fighting in there, I did not know. I just want to know like what people were thinking when they wrote this.
Well, as I understand it, doing research on the film, that the screenwriter sued to have his name taken off. Well, anyway, now that we know the secret discovery, Lenny shows his dumbness because he shows Blake the fatigues he found him in, and Lenny can't tell the difference between blood and red paint. Because he's like, oh, there's blood on this, and I don't know whose it is.
If the paint hadn't dried, you know, then, you know, I think we could forgive him because it's still red. But blood dries brown, right? And this is obviously red paint, so... Yeah.
I don't know. All I know is that the next thing that happens is we get the henchman making a slay joke and threatening people with a T-square in the church. And then we have the great bell tower fight between...
Yes!
You seem excited about this, Letitia.
Well, I might be misremembering now that I got excited. I mean, all I can remember is him falling out. Because of the animatronic Santa, is this the right moment?
Yeah. Yep. He has his problem with these sort of inanimate Santas.
That part made me laugh so hard. I'm still not over it.
Like, Santa just snakes his hand around like waist gently.
I gave the animatronic Santa my best actor award for this film.
It was really good. He was doing what we all wish we could do.
Seriously, Hogan falling out of a bell tower into a pile of garbage is one of my secret fantasies. It's like someone took my dreams and filmed it. Oh, boy. So, Blake, this fall, obviously, as movie amnesia works, you get hit once, you get amnesia, you get hit a second time, you're cured. He regains his memory. And he realizes, oh, no. Those kids are really in trouble. I need to go help them.
Right. Oh, can I say the line, my favorite line? Being Santa opened my eyes, and I didn't like what I saw. Which doesn't really make any sense.
That would have been a great tagline for the film. Being Santa opened his eyes. He didn't like what he saw. That is a good line.
It's pretty good, but it's so ambiguous. I mean, what did he see? I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. He says it so sincerely.
It is so sincere. I loved it.
You know, I've seen worse actors than Hogan.
He's
not bad in this film. He's not great, but he's not terrible.
Hey, hand me my gun. He says with that smile on his face. Not the beginning. The beginning, or just at the beginning, he's extraordinarily awful at the beginning.
Yes,
gets better as he goes along.
Had time to find his character, I guess. You know?
He really got into it. He really felt his way in. He'd earned that line about his eyes being opened by the end there.
I was in this bad movie, and it opened my eyes. I didn't like what I saw.
I'm not going to watch it again.
So now begins the great climax. We have all the villains converge to steal these crystals and make money for Ebner. And Mrs. Watts starts it all off by blowing up the front door like a grenade with her glove. Right after that, we get the geologist tries to jackhammer the vault door, and it's making sparks like an angle grinder. I'm totally lost here.
But we get that new scientist too, right? We get the one with the samurai top knot.
Oh, yes. Sumo lab assistant.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That is Brutus the Barber Beefcake, if you didn't know. If you don't know Brutus the Barber Beefcake, he's a pro wrestler. He's like half Chippendale's dancer, half evil hairdresser. Ooh. And he comes in. So there again, I'm expecting a really great fight scene, and all we get is like Hogan hits him with a bench and he falls down. So
I knew it had to be a wrestler because I'm watching it and I've seen too much early 80s wrestling because when he tore the shirt off, I was like, that looks like a wrestler's body. And I look up the credits, I'm like, Ed Leslie, that's Brutus the Barber Beefcake.
Who also wrestled as Dizzy Hogan. He was booked as Hogan's brother for a while back when they started out. So, but that's sort of like Brutus Beefcake's biggest sort of claim to fame is he just goes wherever Hogan goes. I mean, it's great for him, but, you know, he also end up with this extra scientist. I would have liked to have seen that scientist at the beginning of the movie, because then, you know, you tease the fight between the two, you know? Then she's just waiting for those guys to come together, and when they finally do, there's a big fight, but there's no big fight.
Even if you tease them early on, you can get away with that stupid ending fight. If it's set up as, like, this great showdown, and it ends up by dumb luck, you can get away with that as a joke.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But the fact he just shows up, he's in it for 30 seconds, and then he's out. And you're like, oh, well then.
But what if all your lab assistants are like that big? Now you gotta, now there's danger, right?
Yeah. You know, obviously right before that, Hogan does come to the compound, I think, with the dumbest moves ever. His way of get rid of the cops chasing him. 2 bottles of salad dressing.
Right. Yes.
Well, I couldn't just use one.
Right. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense.
Uses 2 bottles of salad, and somehow it covers up an entire highway and causes 3 cars to skid out.
Moreover, that's a lot of oil in that dressing, right? That's a lot of fat in that dressing for a guy who doesn't eat a cookie.
Yeah, for a guy who's so concerned about cookie and low fat and milk. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Was that his brand dressing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. Of course it was. Okay, yeah. That doesn't make sense then, okay.
Okay, that would make sense if it was just like their brand.
So this is the great scene where we do get that line from Hinckley, the Desert Storm veteran line.
Yeah.
I want to know, when were the California cops ever issued rocket launchers?
Oh my God, right? That doesn't seem safe.
No, but see, there's another moment where it's just cartoon violence, right? This is a cartoon, because this is what Wile E. Coyote would do. He'd pull a rocket launcher out of nowhere and just shoot a rocket at the Roadrunner, and, you know, it would hit a cactus and bounce back at him. But the movie, like, just doesn't want to go full-on cartoon.
That might be the problem with the movie, right? That it doesn't give into the, like you were saying, like, it's not dumb enough.
I think so. I mean, it's too stupid to realize that it needs to be stupider.
I know exactly what you're talking about. If it was more cartoonish, more silly, then I'd accept it more.
Mm-hmm, totally.
It's like the film doesn't know what it wants to be. Does it want to be cute, family-friendly Christmas movie, or does it want to be completely goofy, bad B-movie?
Yeah, just let Dr. Vile start farting. Just have those fart sounds. It's like whenever you see him, and when you hear the fart sound, you're like, oh, no, it's Dr. Vile, and then he shows up, right?
Right, that would be really good. Because I didn't even catch that he was farting until, like, the end.
It's stinky in here. Yeah.
Right, I was like, oh, he farted, okay.
They straight up practically murder the guy, too. Like, they tape him into... By the way, everybody seems to be carrying a roll of duct tape the whole time, it seems. But... they tape him in his hazmat suit and let his gas go. And speaking of straight up murder, Lenny gets his comeuppance, gets his deal by spraying Mrs. Watts with a bucket of water. And I'm like, you just straight up murdered her.
Well, she survives, right? They all survive. No one actually dies.
Yeah, because it's a kids movie, but.
Well, like, and with the help of the children, it seemed like everyone was getting murdered. That was my thought. Like, he's like, hey, kid, let's go murder all these guys. And the kids are helping, and it's a little creepy, but they don't actually die, so I guess it's okay.
They set it up almost like Home Alone style here, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, Hogan gives the kid a fire extinguisher and is like, here's your weapon, monsieur. Oh, we find out in this too, we find out the great secret. Blake once was an orphan at the orphanage, and his best friend was Abner Frost. Again, the selective memory of, like, wait, he doesn't remember his childhood. Even when he gets his memory back, he doesn't remember, oh, that's where I grew up.
But wait, doesn't Frost at one point say, you know, you had your millionaire parents?
At the end, when they're having their fights. But yeah, I wondered that. Like, so did he get millionaire parents? Like, they adopted him?
Yeah.
After he had grown up in an orphanage? Did they adopt a teenager? Because I would still like to be adopted by a millionaire, but yeah, that was very strange.
Brain hurting. So, yeah, they have their great fight scene that is kind of depressingly lame. They're fighting with crystals that are kind of like lightsabers, and yet they make sword clangs. Of course, being a children's film, Hogan wins, but Frost isn't killed. He just gets exposed a la War of the Worlds to air.
Yeah.
Because he's a germaphobe, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't understand that.
I didn't either.
I wasn't paying enough attention, I guess, but I didn't realize he was a germaphobe until he was exposed to the air. In fact, while he was in the suit, I was like, why is he in that hazmat suit?
What?
Are the rest of them suffocating and they don't know it? I just wasn't sure.
So now we get our next trope. This film is so filled with tropes, like the bad guy conversion and Lenny and all that. But we get the next one of, it's gonna blow. Apparently the fight somehow, despite, like, church services for 30 years didn't cause it to blow up, but now a fight is going to. And we get probably one of the most, this is where all their graphics budget went. This is like where half the budget went for this shot. The church destruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She says it's going to blow, which implies explosion, but the building implodes.
Yeah.
And the church looks like stone. It's made of balsa wood.
Balsa stone. Yeah.
Yet I do like one small thing in this, and that's the return of Hinckley, and the windshield wipers are still going on the car.
Well, that's because it was being a cartoon, right? That's a total cartoon move, right? So there you have the movie just being really stupid, and it's fun. But it's sort of when the movie is afraid to be that stupid, where we're like, that's where we're like, oh, I don't know. Why does the kid go off with a slingshot? You know, we don't get it. Because the movie's not brave enough just to be like, the kid's going to go with a slingshot because he's a dynamite shot. And he once killed a buck at like 500 yards with that slingshot. Hit it right in the eye, and it fell down dead, and they ate good for a week, you know? Give me that. And then I say, oh, of course he's going after Frost, because he can do it.
So all the bad guys go off to prison, la 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 la, and we get one final thing, and that's you know, the happy ending. Did he take over Blake's mansion? Or did he take over Ebner's mansion?
That's his own place.
That was his mansion, yeah.
That was his mansion.
I couldn't tell. It looked like Ebner's, but not.
Well, the good guy and the bad guy both live in mansions. That's what we learned. The good guys and bad guys live in the same places.
They're both. So Ebner was rich all along anyway. Why does he care?
Yeah, for real. I mean, that's the bigger question. I didn't understand what he was doing with all these spots. Did you guys put that together? Why is he taking over everything? Is there a reason?
Because he's evil, I guess.
Right. I mean, I guess that's enough, right? You know?
Yeah, it has to be enough. Right? Because if there's anything else.
The rich always want to get richer?
Yeah.
But we get one final shot of them in their prison outfits, and it's like Superman 2. Luther's gang, you know?
Yeah.
That was so weird, though. Like, do they enjoy staring at prisoners? Like, are they that close to the prison?
Do they look?
They have, like, a telescope, binoculars or something, like, trained onto the prison yard? That's so weird. Like, they have the kids come look at these people in prison? That's so strange.
And they know what time it is, because I think one of the kids runs up and goes, it's almost time. Oh, you're
right.
Oh, my God. They know when they're out in the yard.
So weird. And this is how it's confusing as a Christmas movie, right? That is not a very charitable way to end, you know? With, like, staring at prisoners in a yard for your entertainment. It's very odd.
It's like the moral, we get one moment of moral in this film. It's like a third of the way in. It's when Elizabeth, the little girl, says to Santa, is like, you know, always lend a hand if you can. And he repeats back, he's like, you know, a friend once told me that. But that's like a third of the way in the movie. It doesn't, usually you save the moral till the end.
But wait, that's, the rule is actually don't lend a hand because you might need a leg. That's the rule.
There you go. That's why they're watching through the prison. Don't lend a hand to prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might need
a leg. Rule number 351. F those bad guys.
A shit-tastic end shot, though, of the hat on a thing. A hat on a hedge. When...
I'd forgotten that. Oh my gosh, what?
I thought end the movie like 20 seconds before that when he, do a still frame when he throws the hat up. Like, I don't need to be Santa anymore. But, oh boy. My wife watched this film with me and her response was, this movie is unforgivingly bad. But, you know, we've kind of gone breeze through the movie. I want to get your thoughts here. Where does this land on the Christmas canon? Is this, let's say, four levels? Is this a big ticket last present of the day, a regular present, a stocking stuffer, or purchased at Walgreens and barely wrapped in newspaper because the distant family member doesn't even know your interests? Where would you put this on the Christmas canon? Todd, let's start with you.
I'd put it. This is the last present of the day. This is totally the last present of the day. Everything leads to this present. But I don't even like Christmas, so.
So this is going to become, do you think this will become like regular viewing in your house at holiday time?
Probably not.
Probably not, but it's worth the watch.
You know, I found this movie to be really bad, but not so bad that I wanted to watch it again.
That is so perfect. That's really good.
You know, and there are lots of movies that are really bad that I've watched many, many times. But this one, if you do this podcast again for this particular movie, I probably won't do it because I mean, I have to watch it again.
Fair enough, indeed. Letitia, your thoughts, where would this land on the Christmas canon for you?
Well, you know, I think I enjoyed it more than y'all just because it was so ridiculous and I was sort of not paying attention to the details very well. So that made it much more fun. And the animatronic Santa throwing him out of the bell tower and the line about Santa opening his eyes, those for me, I don't know, they're beautiful. I'm never going to watch this again, though. But this is like, I'm really drunk on Christmas, like, and it's like 12 a.m., and I would maybe watch this. That might happen.
If my son buys this at Walmart and wraps it up and gives it to me for Christmas, I will watch it again.
Oh, that's good. That's a good one. That's better.
This to me is going to be a film like RoboCop 2. I'm going to watch it every now and then or watch part of it and keep thinking to myself, this is, it's going to be better this time. I know it. This time it's going to be better and it's always going to disappoint me.
Well, that was your experience this time, right? Because you saw it back in the 90s.
Yeah. And I was expecting, I knew it was going to be pain, but I'm watching it now going, oh boy. Any final thoughts on this film? Or does that kind of say it all for us?
I think that there's like this whole like maybe a canon of bad holiday films, right? And you know, like there was Pia Zadora in Santa Claus versus the Martians, right? That's what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's this sort of category of Santa B movie.
Well, it's like Santa exploitation movies. There's a whole bunch of these. There's like this one with a Christmas tree that talks. Mm-hmm. It is a genre. And I kind of wish this had known that's what it was, as we've been talking about the whole way. Like, if I had known and just embraced that.
Like Santa Slay, right? That movie with Bill Goldberg.
Oh, yeah.
Have the Jewish pro wrestler, and he became, you cast him as the demon who sets out to destroy the Christian holiday. but it's Santa. Santa's a demon who goes out and just destroys everything. knows what it is, you know?
If this film had embraced itself and taken it to just like, you know, Christmas balls to the tree nutty, then it would have been fine.
Yeah, it goes balls to the bark and suddenly you're like, oh, I get it.
No, it's trying to be two or three films at once. Oh, I hope this is not
like a B movie that should have been like, ugly and disgusting and fun and explosive and sometimes violent, but it wanted to be a Hallmark movie.
Right. It needed more violence. It needed the violence to be harder hitting.
Even if it was, yeah, even if it wasn't it was just cartoon violence, right?
Yeah, cartoony art. I always want more violence, but this one really needed it.
If you've got a title like Santa with Muscles, you're going to expect a good fight scene. You know?
I expect, you know, just posing and eye oil. Santa.
That would be a good movie.
I might watch that movie, too.
Well, hopefully this film has not ruined your holiday season or holiday spirit too much. But before we go, real quick, so the folks at home know where they can find you, where can they find you guys online? They want to check out your work and your writings, et cetera, and your other thoughts?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as LETRENT, and all my stuff is there. Facebook, under my name, Letitia Trent.
I have a website, Todd Kaneko. It's TODDKANEKO.com. I'm on Facebook under my name and on Twitter under my name as well. And I'm around. You can find me. I'm pretty easy to find if you Google me and spell my name right.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys both so much for coming on this program, man.
Thank you for putting this whole shindig together and forcing me to watch this movie.
Yeah, I guess thank I will. You.
It was a secret mission to try and get other people to experience my pain. Yes.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thanks, Letitia.
Yeah, thank you guys for being here. It's been a pleasure. Take care and enjoy your holiday.
Happy holidays.
You too. Bye.
Oh boy. Oh boy indeed. Well, that's our general take on the film. Maybe it is a film that deserves the hatred it's gotten over the years. I don't know. Hopefully we didn't crush the holiday spirit within you and you've still got enough to enjoy the Christmas holiday or whatever holidays you may be celebrating over the next week and a half. What did you think of the episode here? This is our first time we've ever done this. Had a episode roundtable discussion with multiple guests and talked about one specific topic. Did you like it? Would you like to hear us do it again sometime? Maybe for a different film? Have different folks on? Maybe, who knows, maybe not tackle a movie, tackle a TV show, a book or something. Contact us here at the SAFTAcast. We'd love to hear what you thought of this, and if you think we should do it again, you can shoot us a message on Facebook by searching out our show name, SAFTAcast. You can also find us on Twitter at SAFTAcast, SAFTACAST, or you can shoot us an email at SAFTAcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Really, really curious what your thoughts are on this episode. Before we close this out completely, though, one last thing to you. Those of you who are celebrating the Christmas holiday, we here at the podcast wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas. If you do not celebrate it, then we wish you all the best the holiday season has to offer, many good things. May you get the chance to talk to friends and family that you love dearly, connect with them, spend some time with them, enjoy whatever delights are around you, and try to do that throughout 2017. Quick program note about the show, and for the next week or so, we, like many across the globe, will be taking a little bit of a holiday break, but we will return shortly after New Year's with the now annual Sundress and Safta New Year's message, so look for that right after New Year's. Maybe not New Year's Day, maybe the second or so, but it will be up in the first few days, and then in mid-January, we will return with all new episodes and promos. Until then, this is Scott C., just saying to you all, once again, may you enjoy the holiday season. Even though we can't see you, because this is audio only, we hope to see you back here in January for another amazing year of the SAFTAcast. Take care, everybody, and don't forget to keep the milk and cookies warm.